Blog Talk Radio.
Retired journalist, once known as Ted Koppel, attacked the conservative world via Sean Hannity recently. What a smug joke. Hannity called on Koppel to give some credit to people's ability to differentiate between a news show and an opinion show. "You're cynical," Hannity said. "I am cynical," Koppel responded. "Do you think we're bad for America? You think I'm bad for America?" Hannity asked. Well, Ted Koppel didn't miss a beat. "Yeah," he said and continued over multiple interruptions from the shocked and beleaguered and writhing in pain Sean Hannity. Well, maybe not writhing in pain, but he shouldn't be surprised. But I've got this, Ted Koppel is one of these, I would call him an ultra uber elite. Not because he went to Harvard and Yale, although he did go to Stanford. He went to Syracuse and Stanford, but I'd call him an ultra elite because he was, I think, highly considered when he was on TV. And he did a show that started off with kind of a countdown on the Iranian hostage crisis. And then that turned into Nightline. But what Ted Koppel has in spades is this incredible, condescending, self-righteous, and kind of, you know, very, very confident liberalism that isn't just an opinion. It is, you know, it's from God's lips. Although I doubt you see Ted Koppel going to church. He's Jewish. You know, it's, you know, what I find interesting is so many of these celebrities and media types, their parents or their grandparents escaped Nazi Germany, and they end up working for liberalism, which I find so ironic. But here's this clip. You know, your family barely survives an attack of fascism or basically leftism. There's not much difference between fascism and communism, no matter what craziness might be tweeted out by the supine and disengaged Frankie. Although, you know, Frankie, my secretary, who's also very liberal and possibly more liberal than you, is really getting sick of your emails. But let's see if I can play this little clip here. Starting to have computer problems already. No, hold on a second here. Let's see if I can shut down some of this stuff. But anyway, Ted Koppel, I mean, you know, talk about somebody who's really thinks that they're beyond any level of criticism, that they've tapped into reality. I mean, you ever get this where you open up an internet page and it starts bouncing a little bit? I find that weird. But anyway, I've got 10,000 things to get into for you today. All right, let me see here if I can solve this by kind of, you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to close this thing down and reopen it because I'd like you to be able to hear this stuff. But I was not, I mean, of all the people that I wouldn't be surprised would say something like this, it's Ted Koppel, but I don't, you know, I really don't understand where a lot of these people are coming from with their really super, super duper smug attitude, why they represent, but that is, it's really liberalism in a nutshell, isn't it? This idea that you're in touch with reality and other people aren't. And where has that, how has that helped us? The Obamas, the Clintons, this idea that there's only this elite group that is in touch with reality. If you listened yesterday, then I thought it was an amazing clip. David Horowitz traces this stuff back into what they actually believe. And I was amazed that he really had done his homework, although he's a very smart guy. David Horowitz was a far leftist. As a matter of fact, he was an editor for Ramparts, which was the most important liberal magazine back in the 1960s. He transitioned from that. His mother was a communist, a card-carrying communist and Democrat, member of the Democratic Party. And he transitioned from that into conservatism. And he talked about this desire by these far leftists to save the planet. Well, to save humanity, really, by killing people, weirdly enough. They can't get over their bad habit of killing people, killing mass numbers of people. But he's saying that heaven is on earth. We're going to create utopia. We're going to force or trick or lie or manipulate people into utopia, and therefore we're going to save the world. But anyway, here's Ted Koppel. You know who Ted Koppel's best friend was? Maybe still is. And he was glad. Henry Kissinger. All right, so here we go. Here's Ted Koppel telling Sean Hannity to his face he's bad for America.
Think we're bad for America? You think, yeah. I'm bad for America?
Yeah.
You do.
In the long haul, I think you,
really?
And all these opinion
That's
shows.
That's sad, Ted.
No, you know why?
That's sad.
Because you're very good at what you do, and because you have attracted a significantly more influential.
You are selling the
American
people short.
Let me finish the sentence before you do that.
With all due respect.
You have attracted people who are determined that ideology is more important than facts.
In other words, fanatics, right? So it's the far left that's in touch with reality, with facts like global warming, the Earth's cooking us to death, or the temperatures, the weather's changing. Fit in whatever little spin you want to put there, the facts that capitalism is bad, that, you know, all the, I don't want to bore you with all the so-called facts, but if the facts of leftism are true, when you apply them, why don't they ever work out? You know? And if the facts of, say, Obamacare were true, why did he have to lie to get people to support him? And now we've got this, like, permanent disaster called Obamacare hanging over us, like it's like a twister that's about to come down. And, you know, so there's this guy, this one of these House members who just put up a bill, which I think is beautiful, a one-line bill. We will repeal Obamacare, basically. All right, here's Ted Koppel tangling with Bill O'Reilly. Ted Koppel is like rising up from the graveyard to attack the people that have taken away the kind of positions that he used to have.
Joins us now from Washington. So let's assess Donald Trump. I've interviewed him a number of times. Not an easy interview. How would you do it?
You know something, Bill, you and I have talked about this general subject many times over the years. It's irrelevant how I would do it. And you know who made it irrelevant?
So this guy is just like King Cheap Shot.
You did. You have changed the television landscape over the past 20 years. You took it from being objective and dull to being subjective and entertaining. And in this current climate, it doesn't matter what the interviewer asks him. Mr. Trump is going to say whatever he wants to say, it, as outrageous as it may be.
Okay, but, you know, your old network, ABC, does interview Mr. Trump on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And, you know, our job, whether I'm a commentator or a reporter, is to get as much information, number one, and two, show the viewer who the person really is. So again, I'll go back to, he's sitting on Nightline, you're opposed, right opposite him. How do you do it?
Well, the first way you do it is not in the interview. You do it by some reporting. It's an old-fashioned concept, but I think demonstrating who and what Mr. Trump is and what his very...
Oh, my God, this guy is so nasty. Cheap shot after cheap shot.
His policies really amount to is something you don't do in an interview. He doesn't answer the questions.
As you pointed out, it's a whole different ballgame on cable TV. Commentators like me have just ruined the country. I cop to that.
It's true. You have.
Right. I've ruined everything.
Ted Koppel. Wow, what a psycho. Do you imagine living next door to that guy? I mean, I wonder what he would have complained about, or what he wouldn't complain about. All right, looking for here. I've got one more clip on this. I just find this kind of thing is I don't know if the kind of Ted Koppel attitude is as common as, you know, but it's just so, I mean, it is so, I mean, it'd be like going up to somebody, let's say a guy that was the president of a bank, asked for interaction with the community, say the minority community, to assess, you know, how the bank is trying to find out how it can do a better job. And I'm trying to multitask here, but so he trying to figure out the bank is trying to do outreach or whatever. And the person said, you know, the bank president says, how can we do a better job with a minority community? And the person who's the leader of the minority or whatever, the liberal expert comes up and says, well, number one, you can stop stealing from poor people. You know, that's like the Ted Koppel way. And he's so here's this thing. This comes out of the kind of this thing called the Enlightenment that I'm sure that you've heard of. The Enlightenment was the thing in history that the movement in history that supposedly brought science and reason, enlightenment, you know, into society and was going to get all rid of prejudice and religion and everything. And it really hasn't worked out that way. It's just a new form of religion, religious persecution, and idiotic, mindless zealots like Ted Kappel, who's apparently thinks he's always right. Here's a little more analysis on this. I find this guy so entertaining.
We have to give some credit to the American people that they're somewhat intelligent and that they know the difference between an opinion show and a news show.
Yeah.
You're cynical. Look at that. Yeah.
I am cynical because,
you think we're bad for America? You think I'm bad for America?
Yeah.
You do.
In the long haul, I think you and all these opinion
That's
shows.
That's sad, Ted.
No, you know why?
That's sad.
Because you're very good at what you do and because you have attracted a significantly more influential.
Well,
let me finish the sentence. Let me finish the sentence before you do that.
With all due respect,
you have attracted people who are determined that ideology is more important than facts.
This exchange getting a lot of attention this morning. That was CBS. That was on CBS The Morning Show. Sean Hannity and Ted Koppel going back and forth about, hey, are you bad for America or not? That's what Ted Koppel is alleging Sean Hannity.
The problem is he only gave him 44 seconds when he sat down with him for 45 minutes.
That's right.
Exactly. Go to Sean's Twitter page and see how he responded. Let's bring in Dana Lash. She is the national spokesperson for the NRA and the host of Dana on.
I want to point out one thing here that Ted Kappel has this massive interview with Sean Hannity, and he tells him during the interview, we're not going to play any of this. So he just gives him a tiny soundbite out of this just to set him up and make him look bad.
And Blaze TV and has a successful radio show. Good morning to you, Dana.
Good morning. Thanks for having
me. You're welcome. What'd you think about that?
It seemed weird. I grew up watching Ted Koppel be one of the most biased anchors in America. And so for him to kind of turn that around, it was one of those moments where you do a double take. He's been accused of bias, Ted Koppel, throughout his entire career. He's the last person on earth to be accusing anyone of being bad for America simply because they're offering opinion. And this is the problem with so much of legacy media. This is why you've seen new media crop up, because people are tired of these anchors and these reporters giving their opinion as unfettered fact and acting as though there's no bias on their part at all whatsoever.
Dana,
I appreciate people who give their opinion and they openly say, you know what, this is my opinion. Like for me, for instance, I'm completely biased towards the Constitution and towards natural rights. Obviously, everything that I talk about is going to be through that perspective. That's the difference between people like me and people like Ted Koppel, is that we're honest, whereas they are not.
Is he just utterly and completely unaware? I mean, is he just no self-awareness that he himself would also have a bias?
Yes, and it's also a huge insult to the American people, who I think don't need Ted Koppel to come to their rescuing. We don't need Ted Koppel to save us. We're smart enough to figure out what is propaganda and what is not. And for someone like Ted Koppel to act as like the ombudsman now, it seems, considering everything that he's done to contribute to this problem, that's the height of hypocrisy. No.
His view is, I like the way things used to be, where the New York Times is it, and then we could debate about the New York Times being the standard. They actually reset the New York Times to straighten out America. But in the big picture, you know what? I love the topic, though, and I think it's 100% true, Dana. Do you find the fact that in that piece they exposed that Democrats and Republicans don't even want to hear the other person's argument about a lot of times, and that is showing a divide, a lack of listening? Do you buy the premise of the piece?
I think there is some truth to that. I mean, there's always a grain of truth in some of these accusations. I do think that people are really tribalistic right now.
Yep.
And we need.
Anyway, that I thought that was a good analysis. And here is listening to the Allman Brothers. Allman Brothers, basically, I mean, Dwayne Allman starts off as a guitar player, and within a couple of years is rated as one of the greatest guitar players in history. And so, and then he was driving his motorcycle and he ran into the back end of some big truck, wasn't really watching what he was doing. He was a very I got a book on him. He was a very self-destructive kind of a guy. There's a story when he was in, I think he was in high school or after he'd gone to high school, he had gone up in this building, and on top of the building was a Christmas tree. There's some sort of a Christmas tree, obviously, during the winter, and he crawled up to the top of this thing, and it was swaying back and forth, and it looked like he was going to, you know, fall off. This building was like 10 stories, as I recall. But anyway, we'll take a little break here, man. I got 1,000 topics for you, and each one of them's juicy. Kelly O'Connell, AM Les Cruz, the same, 1450, 523, 1450. And Ted Capel, go back to the graveyard. You're toast. Hey, it's Kelly. Bob.
Good morning, Kelly.
Bob.
Yes, you're the boss. Kelly, there's going to be a wedding, and I want you to speak to it. Speak at it at the Las Cruces Civic Center.
I want to play the organ at it.
Well, I want you to do both.
When are you getting married?
We haven't decided.
How long have you known this lady?
I talked to Mike Markowski of Chris Markowski in Florida, and we didn't get far. But my reason for calling you is, what time is the county meeting today? You know?
Oh man, what a great question.
Is it 11?
Aren't they always? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Don't let me interrupt, Bob. Go ahead.
I apologize, sir. Yeah, Kelly, I'd like you everything. We're gonna build a court. I don't know how I'm gonna do that, but you need to be on the court.
Sounds good, man.
Okay, and your wife.
All right. Anything
else? Yes, love you very much. And I'm gonna be my best behavior when I go to the county courthouse today.
Bob.
Okay?
Bob, that's not like you to be on your best behavior. What's going on?
Well, I saw Scott Kraling, the clerk.
The crawfish? Kraling crawfish?
Well, I think he shaved his hairy beard.
Well, maybe he realized that being seafood does not allow you to have a beard, you know?
And yesterday, in reference to Jill, she loves you.
Who?
I noticed how you closed up my speaking on the radio yesterday. And Jill loves you.
All right.
Well, we're probably later.
Hey, we're about to come
on
the air, Bob.
I'm going to church.
Bob.
Yes.
Bob, we're about to come on the air. Are you ready to perform?
Yes.
All right. What are we going to talk about?
We're going to talk about the jail.
All right. Here we go. It's 6:27, and believe it or not, we've got a call from Bob. And Bob, you wanted to talk about the jail?
What? Yes, sir. You're an honor. Let me begin by saying that I really love listening to Ben, and he's a good buddy. I saw him at his church. But, yeah, I spent some time at the jail a couple of years back on some false accusations, and I was appalled at what I saw.
Well, I'd love to hear about these false accusations. Am I allowed to guess what the false accusations
yes.
were? Impersonating
yes.
impersonating a traffic ticket officer.
Didn't see that.
Oh, okay. Well, all right. So,
okay. What I'm trying to refer to is that I'd like to address the county commissioners today, and I'm going to mention my experience at the jail, and county clerk Scott Kraling was there. And he's not saying much. And Scott and I consider Scott a friend, but he's real quiet. But I notice when you go to a government building, it's all politics. I'm not accustomed to that. So I'm going to do the best I can. I'll be casual. And let's see what happens, okay? But I'm going to really eyeball County Commissioner Juan Vasquez.
Juan the Don Vasquez, is he a ladies' man?
Is that the one we're talking about?
I don't know.
You don't even have a city councilor because of him, because of where I live?
Really?
Yeah, I asked for my voting papers, and I have a zero for city council. So I don't even qualify.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Zero. So, is that, you know what? Hey, Bob. Zero.
Bob.
Turn on your miracle ear. You know, zero is a good place to start. You can only go up.
Yeah, just waiting until you get zero phone calls.
Oh, I got you. So, were you arrested for impersonating a school nurse?
No, that's not my forte. That's not my style. What I do is I just love them.
Love who, though?
You can't go wrong.
Okay,
well, look, I know you got other people that want to call in, Kelly, and I'm not quite informed as I should be because I haven't been reading like I want,
Bob,
to.
Bob.
There's some good people here in New Mexico, and if anybody qualifies for an honorary doctorate, Kelly O'Connell, everybody's friend.
A dishonorary doctorate. So does Scott Kraling sit in the corner and puff on an electronic cigarette and just kind of, like, you know, does he have, like, dark glasses on? He's just taking it all in?
No, that's not Scott.
Oh, okay.
Scott's a married man. He's a good man. He's very concerned about our community, and he's under a lot of pressure all the time because people are always talking about a voter registration fraud. You know, so
well,
what I know.
They were trying to help the county. They were selling IDs to try to fundraise because they know how desperately in need of income we are.
And you telling me that my city commissioner Juan L. Valdez was involved in that?
Was he? I don't know. I mean, this is the first I've heard of it.
I don't even know where he lives.
Hopefully, somewhere within the confines of the state, or at least the county.
Well, maybe he'll get a pardon from our illustrious, wonderful, I love her, Susana Martinez.
You never know. Stranger things have happened, though. Probably not much stranger.
Definitely.
Thanks, Bob.
Yes,
have a good day.
Yes, sir. God bless you.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. All right. Bob has invited me to his wedding, and I said, hey, let me play the organ there. All right. So, well, I think it is time, my friends, for a little bit of local news. 523-1450. Didn't Scott Kraling hire Lynn Ellen's DeGeneres as his sidekick? And I'm sure Bill Gaylord McCamley is hanging around, the gay evangelist. We'll take a break here and be right back. 523-1450 AM Las Cruces. Thanks for tuning in. It's just great to hang out with you. And today is the 28th. This year is just exploding, isn't it? We'll be right back.
Because, well, instead of bands getting popular because they were rich, they got
All right, so let me get to a couple of headlines here for you. Google News says House Democrats asked Devin Nunes to recuse himself from Russia inquiry. Stick in there, man. Who cares what those bums think? It is a transparent attempt to create a connection between Trump and Russia that doesn't exist, obviously, or they'd already have something on the guy. So what I suggest is that Devin Nunes, I thought it was cool, kind of cool what he did. Now, was it against the rules or the decorum? It may have been, but these guys are trying to run these committees to shoot down Trump, and because Nunes stands up and actually pushes back, they flip out. And that guy Schiff, he looks like, you know, that guy is just so weird looking. Not to point fingers at the strange looks of others, but looks like a clam that grew a head or something. He's got this like kind of very thin neck and kind of a bobblehead. Anyway, 23 people asked the Justice Department to launch a criminal inquiry into its chief, Jeff Sessions. Of course, what's the left famous for? Misusing the machinery of bureaucracy to destroy people, right? All right, some more here. Ivanka Trump, Jared Kushner rising in power. Here, okay, why is his family rising? Because he can trust them as much as he can trust anybody. Trump, Ford announcing a major Michigan investment. You know, the fact of the matter is, hating somebody because it's your job to hate them is really not worth much. And I think the Democratic Party, it's ultimately going to harm them. It's also harming the country, of course, but they don't care about that. World's biggest dinosaur footprint found in Australia, and they showed a guy laying down next to it. It was the size of a full grown man laying on the ground. Yeah, let's see what else. Okay, so let's what gave some primates bigger brains? A fruit-filled diet. I'm sure that the homosexual apostle will be glad to find that out. All right, here's some. Here is more. Well, let's take a little break on this one, and I'm looking for. Okay. I've got a clip on sanctuary cities because I think it's a big deal. There is a statement from Sessions is getting sued by 29 liberals for his criminal activities. that such as jaywalking, that they're going to go after these sanctuary cities. Check this out.
The Department of Justice has a duty to enforce our nation's laws, including our immigration laws. Those laws require us to promptly remove aliens when they are convicted or detained of certain crimes. The vast majority of American people support this common sense requirement. According to one recent poll, 80% of Americans believe that cities that arrest illegal immigrants for crimes should be required to turn them over to immigration authorities. Unfortunately, some states and cities have adopted policies designed to frustrate this enforcement of immigration laws. This includes refusing to detain known felons under federal detainer request or otherwise failing to comply with these laws. For example, the Department of Homeland Security recently issued a report showing that in a single week, there were more than 200 instances of jurisdictions refusing to honor ICE detainer requests with respect to individuals charged or convicted of a serious crime. The charges and convictions against these aliens include drug trafficking, hit and run, rape, sex offenses against a child, and even murder. Such policies cannot continue. They make our nation less safe by putting dangerous criminals back on the streets. We all remember the tragic case of Kate Steinle, the 32-year-old woman who was shot and killed 2 years ago in San Francisco as she walked along a pier with her father. The shooter, Francisco Sanchez, was an illegal immigrant who had already been deported 5 times and had 7 felony convictions. Just 11 weeks before the shooting, San Francisco had released Sanchez from its custody, even though Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers had filed a detainer requesting that he be held in custody until immigration.
I have something else piping up there. So anyway, what they're proposing to do. I don't know if that was background from the same clip, but you're getting the idea. The government is going to cut off funding for sanctuary cities. Now, what do you think about that? What do you think about the leadership from the city council? What do you think about the leadership from the county commission? What do you think about being designated as an area that is a sanctuary city? Now, I would like to know what the average person who is Hispanic in this county thinks of sanctuary cities. If you're here legally, you don't have to be a citizen, but if you're here legally and you're Hispanic, what do you think about illegal Hispanics or any other group coming here to hide or to not be picked up? I'm just curious. 523-1450. Now, all right, a little break here for an announcement. We have a new judge, folks, in the district court. It is Conrad Perea, and I just wanted to give you a little background on him. Truly a great judge down there. Wonderful temperament to be a judge. Doesn't get angry easily. Very patient, listens, from my experience. He was chosen by Susana Martinez. Now, that was between he and James Dickens. James Dickens had run against Mark D'Antonio for district attorney. And so a little description here from the Sun News. 35 years of legal and law enforcement experience, was a police officer, Las Cruces Police Department, 19 years, 79 to 99. Once served as special agent in charge of Las Cruces Doniana County Metro Narcotics Agency and director of the police academy down here, training officers for 25 years. Prey is also a graduate of the FBI Investigations National Academy and Border Patrol Academy. And he had been a magistrate court judge before in 1999, handled the DWI caseload, and then went to he graduated from New Mexico State in 2000, received his Juris Doctorate from University of Denver 2004. University of Denver has very high standards. You have to test very well to get in there. So obviously Judge Perea is a very smart guy. And so anyway, I think that I do know that Susanna was on friendly terms with James Dickens, who's also a fine man. And what I'm thinking is, you know, Perea had the experience. I think it would be good if Dickens were interested to go and be put into the magistrate court here to be trained, if that was the opinion or decision by the governor, and then get a little seasoning there and then move up for the next position, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, congratulations, Judge Perea. And it is in a very overworked court down at the district court. So here's a little Jim Gaffigan cheese joke.
All I do in Wisconsin is eat cheese. I know it's a cliche, but in Wisconsin, it's like they're trying to get rid of it. Oh, hey, you want some cheese? I just woke up. That's a yeah, right? Have you ever eaten so much cheese you think, I may never use the bathroom again? People on the East Coast think that's weird. In the Midwest, that's Monday.
All right, so anyway, we'll take a little break here and be right back. I've got something on the possibility of rinse, wash, repeat, rinse Priebus leaving the White House. A lot of people will be happy to hear that. Got some local weather for you. 523-1450 AM, Las Cruces, Kelly O'Connell. 646. Okay, two things to consider together here, and one of which is White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus coincidental that Judge Jeanine called for Paul Ryan to resign after Trump Twitter plug. So anyway, there's an article here, if you can get to it, and it's an American Thinker. Paul Ryan's catastrophic lack of political judgment. Trying to bring forward a bill that was not going to pass was absurd. Now, here's Reince Priebus, the chief of staff.
Yesterday morning, the president tweeted this, and I want to put it up. Watch Judge Jeanine on Fox News at 9 p.m. Now, we all love Judge Jeanine on Fox News.
I do love Judge Jeanine.
But we were curious as to why he would call her out. Here was the start of her show last night.
My opening statement. Paul Ryan needs to step down as Speaker of the House.
Does the president want Paul Ryan to resign as Speaker?
Well, first of all, I will go on record. We do love Judge Jeanine, and so does the president. I think it was more coincidental, Chris. I did not talk to the president about the tweet. I'm just telling you the truth. There was no pre-planning here.
Why would he say watch her and then that's the first thing
because
out of
he
mind?
Loves Judge Jeanine and he wanted to do Judge Jeanine a favor.
So does he want Paul Ryan to step down or
no? No, he doesn't. And he's talked to Paul Ryan yesterday for about an hour. He believes what he said in the Oval Office on Friday. He doesn't blame Paul Ryan. In fact, he thought Paul Ryan worked really hard. He enjoys his relationship with Paul Ryan, thinks that Paul Ryan's a great Speaker of the House. So none of that has changed. I think this is more of a personal relationship, the president helping out a friend.
I know. The friend was Judge Jeanine, not Paul Ryan.
Well, both of them are. But
as
to the tweet, yes.
Okay.
That's hilarious. All right. Round two. Goodbye, Priebus, according to this report from... This is from Real Clear Politics. Here we go.
I'm not in any trouble. I've got a great relationship with the president. We talk all the time. In fact, just before coming on the set, he gave me a call. This is gossip hounds, and, you know, it's always going to happen, and I don't really care about it.
White House Chief of Staff Ryan Priebus this morning denying reports his job is in jeopardy after the Republican health care bill failed. Joining me now, Tara Palmieri, White House correspondent for Politico, and Jeremy Peters from the New York Times. Always good to see you both. We'll go ladies first here with you, Tara, because I saw that tweet you put out there yesterday. You were the first one to really get it out there, saying source close to the president says he's being advised to replace Reince and is open to possibility health care was last straw. So your reaction on what you heard there from Reince?
I'm not surprised to hear that. He still has the job for now, but I know from my sources that the president is being advised. One of my sources was one of those advisors saying that he should look for another chief of staff. Reince was billed as the person who could deal with the House and the Senate. He's very close with Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. And this was a serious failure for him and his team. And this isn't his only failure. You saw the travel ban roll out. There are barely any appointees going through the Senate. I mean, you basically have a bare bones staff in the federal government right now on top of a slew of other issues. But, you know, Reince is hanging on, and Trump is not the type of person to accept blame. And who is the most senior person there inside of the White House who is supposed to deal with the team that essentially, you know, failed Trump?
Yeah. Jeremy, similar reporting from the New York Times. This was Friday evening, and here's what it said. On Friday evening, a somewhat shell-shocked president retreated to the White House residence to grieve and assign blame. In a search for scapegoats, he asked his advisors repeatedly, whose fault was this? Increasingly, that blame has fallen on Reince Priebus. So why does this matter?
Well, it matters because there has always been this lingering mistrust of Priebus from day one when Trump announced that he was going to name him White House Chief of Staff. You had a chorus of outrage, especially on the right, you know, within the deepest conservative element of the Republican Party, that Reince Priebus was not to be trusted. He was always seen as kind of an establishment insider, the very type of Republican that Trump ran against and vowed to run out of the party. But Trump needs establishment players like that in his cabinet because he is not in full control of the party. If anything, what these last 48, 72 hours have shown us is that the Republican Party is fractured, and it's not just the far right that is in trouble. I mean, you have moderates who broke off from this. You have members of party leadership who broke off on health care. It's really in disarray.
What about Reince Priebus, who reacted to TV host Judge Jeanine Pirro's comments ahead of her interview with the president, where she called on House Speaker Paul Ryan to resign? Here's what Reince Priebus said.
Does he want Paul Ryan to step down or no?
No, he doesn't. And he's talked to Paul Ryan yesterday for about an hour. He believes what he said in the Oval Office on Friday. He doesn't blame Paul Ryan. In fact, he...
All right, so his head's supposed to be on the chopping block. Now, Paul Ryan... How do you bring a bill forward and then watch that bill go up in flames and not know as the leader of the House whether it's going to pass or not? And the reason is, or the way that happens, is by not being in contact. And Paul Ryan is only representing Paul Ryan's interests, and he's a leftist in my opinion, in the GOP. And so he can't represent the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus or whatever it's called, who are necessary to get that bill forward. 6:55, we'll take one last break. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 523-1450. We're going to come back in the next hour with some local news. A few more headlines. Gallup, Trump slipping to 36% approval rating, higher than Reagan, lower than Obama and Clinton. Congress gearing up for fight over spending, divisions threaten tax cuts. Overhaul effort lacks advantage Reagan enjoyed in 86. Wounded Paul Ryan facing new battle. Representative files one-sentence bill to repeal Obamacare. And L.A. mayor vows sanctuary. Illegals free to roam, Godfather defiant in Chicago. And your bill to rescind this act may be cited as the Obamacare Repeal Act, effective as December 31, 2017. The Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is repealed, and the provisions of law amended or repealed by such act are restored or revived as if such act had not been enacted. Wow. That's what you're talking about there. Massive, massive and tiny yet massive. 659 Amos Cruises will take you out with some Allman Brothers. 523-1450 coming back with some state news. I woke up this morning, I had them space for blue. Okay, so in some state news, we are talking a continuing crisis in the budget, and Governor Martinez is laying out various proposals to deal with the shortfall, and she talks about furloughs, and she of government employees, she vowed not to sign any tax measures and said she would soon be calling back to Santa Fe. And this is on March 27th. So this is from yesterday. Lawmakers back to renegotiate a $6.1 billion budget for next year. Cash reserves dwindling. It will soon leave state finance officials unable to cut checks. And the governor warned that it will affect the state's ability to make payroll and pay contracts. And she says, quote, "We are facing a crisis. And this has become truly a result of the inaction of our legislature. We are staring down the path of a government shutdown." And, okay, so furloughs are kind of ugly, huh? Now, in other news, and this is to just to put in there, and this is from the Sun News, dependence on federal funding among top in nation for here. We were number one. We're now number three. But still way up there. We've got a lot of military bases, Holloman, Cannon, Kirtland, and White Sands. We host two national laboratories. And we get, for every dollar we put into the system, we get $4.50 back. So of the 825,000 people employed in the state, 200,000 are government employees. All right. So what if the government, what if the Fed said, we are going to transfer our contracts out of areas where there is a sanctuary city status, sanctuary state, sanctuary county status? What would happen there if they said, basically, we're going to transfer military people out of this area because of sanctuary status now? We don't have a military base. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, Alamogordo, and there's the base down in El Paso. So, but what I mean, just saying, if they really wanted to play hardball, what would the city leaders, what would the county leaders, state leaders do? Kind of seems like a dire situation, to be totally honest. And there's a report, solar job growth in the state is exploding. And let me take a break here. I'm having a little more computer problems. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450. We'll be right back. It's 7:12, and I've got an article here from the Albuquerque Journal, and it is basically on the topic of what would happen if there was a mass deportation. And, you know, I'm still having problems here with this Hold on just a second. I'm still having problems with my computer. I keep rebooting it, but not sure what's going on. But anyway, they say that we could lose up to $1.5 billion in income because of this attempt to, they call the really the danger of the of losing these people. And they say that 4% of the population is illegal, one of the highest ratios in the United States. And they say government spending is based on a 10-year census, which is not linked into whether a person's legal or illegal. So let's see if I can get this thing back up here. All right, deportations could devastate New Mexico economy. And this is from Albuquerque Journal, Kevin Robinson Avila. And this guy says, if the undocumented immigrant population in New Mexico disappeared, the state could lose tens of millions of dollars each year in federal money and local taxes. And what he says is we could lose up to $1.5 billion. And based on the estimates of the state's Robert Radigan, he's a demographer and associated with University of New Mexico Geospatial and Population Studies. And federal funding from everything from Medicaid to education, transportation, and housing grants is based on a 10-year U.S. Census Bureau survey of each state's population. Those surveys are based on gross numbers that ignore nationality and immigration status. There are no official numbers on undocumented immigrants in New Mexico, but Pew Research Center estimates about 85,000 people, more than 90% from Mexico, illegally reside here as of 2014, representing 4% of the state total population, giving us one of the top 10 ratios in the country. And this Radigan says, little quote from him, if you take that population out of the next census count in 2020, it would have a huge monetary impact, more so than most other states. And a rough estimate is that each new Mexican resident not counted costs us about $2,000 per year for the next 10 years. If 80,000 people left by 2020 at $2,000 a person, that would be a loss of $1.5 billion over 10 years. And that revenue is part of the general pool of federal money that flows into the government programs benefiting the states. And so, anyway, just to bear that in mind. All right, so let me see here. We've got, and we do have a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yes, my boss, Kelly. Kelly, I have a comment concerning Albuquerque. Bob. Is it a sanctuary city?
Yes, I think we are a sanctuary county or city, whatever. Yeah, I think we're sanctuary coming and going. Why?
Well, because if they would stop the shock treatments and slow down on the abortion, they wouldn't have to worry about looking to the red all the time, in the negative, I mean.
Well, what about your buddy Ken Miyagashima? I mean, have you talked to him over a hamburger over this issue?
No, we don't do hamburgers.
What do you do?
Salad bars and filet mignon.
Wow, must be nice living large.
Live and learn.
All right, Bob.
Love you, Kelly.
Thanks, bye. All right, folks. So Trump made comments and now backed up by Jeff Sessions, vowing to cut federal funding to so-called sanctuary cities. And this is from November 19th last year. So there's no fixed definition of a sanctuary city or county, but, and the name of city, the city of Las Cruces, usually doesn't appear, but let's look at Doniana County. This is from the Sun News. Doniana County government has two immigrant-friendly policies that could open us up to scrutiny from Trump. In 2014, commissioners passed a safe communities measure that applied to the county's more than 800 employees, including those within the county sheriff's department. The measure prohibits county employees from requesting information about or transmitting information regarding the immigration status of a person, stipulating county services or benefits upon immigration status, including on application forms such as for benefits or services, questions about immigration standing, helping or cooperating in one's official capacity with any U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement or Customs and Border Protection investigation, detention, or arrest procedures, public or clandestine, related to alleged violations of the civil provisions of federal immigration law. So, I ask you, are we a sanctuary city? It seems like we're a sanctuary city and a sanctuary county. Now, Doña Ana County Undersheriff Ken Roberts says that these policies didn't have much effect on the department's actions. My officers were never out enforcing immigration laws or tracking people down to begin with. As far as us being an immigrant service, that was never an issue for us. Now, let me ask you this. If we're going through massive budget shortfalls, should the state look to get people who are immigrants, say illegal immigrants who are on state welfare out? What if they left everybody who was working and just got rid of the ones that were here illegally on government aid? I mean, is it reasonable that people would come from another country and come here and get on state welfare or federal welfare? Do you think that's a reasonable thing? Do you think it's their right? Do you think it's our duty to provide that? Now, for DASO, a relatively large federal grant is Operation Stone Garden. You've probably heard of that before. The Sheriff's Department receives pay for patrols meant to counter crime along the border, though it's not aimed at immigration enforcement. It pays for overtime for the department to focus on drug interdiction and that type of thing. And we have another call here. Thank you for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
It's Ralph Kelly.
Good morning, Ralph. How you doing? Hope you're well.
Thank you. Hey, Kelly. When I got ready to retire, I moved to Las Cruces after I've been gone since 52, more or less. And I tried to help out a contractor here in Cruces. He had declared bankruptcy. I inherited 10 men on a crew I supervised. 9 out of those 10 were from Mexico.
All right.
Good workers.
Yeah.
The wages were atrocious. Where I was supervising, my men were getting, the lowest paid was $11.76 on skilled labor, semi-skilled. Here, high-skilled labor were getting $4.80. I couldn't believe it. I went to the general superintendent and I mentioned it to him. He says, don't worry, you'll have a raise on the next paycheck. I took the checks, no raise. Up 5 miles east of Alamogordo and left. I called my daughter to go pick me up. Through the man went and said, don't leave. We do not want a raise. If we have a 25-cent raise, we will lose La Ayuda, which is welfare. We will lose the rent, the electricity, the gas that's being paid for us, the doctors, hospitalization, prescriptions, and so much per head for each child. And they had, one had six. There was two men that talked to me. One had six and the other one had 7. So
all
these
right.
men would not accept.
Oh, I understand.
A raise.
And so let me ask you something. Out of the group of people that you had, how many were legal versus illegal immigrants?
I don't know. None of them knew English.
No, that
but none of them would accept a raise.
Well,
I said, what if I force the company to give you a raise? They said, well, I'll leave.
All right, so what do you think of this idea? Get the people who are here illegally on welfare out, but leave the ones who are working in. What do you think about that?
As long as they get off of Medicaid, as long as there's no government subsistence, it'd be fine. You know, I worked out there by the Canadian line, northwestern Montana, and there was only one Hispanic name. That was a Garcia.
Uh-huh.
And Kalispell phone book, and I worked Kalispell, Columbia Falls, Whitefish, Polson, and all that Canadian line. And you had Rocky, the Gang Tex Force, with a surf department on one day, and I called in, and he said, "That's right." Over 3 years, I never saw one Hispanic or one black.
Sounds like an Aryan Nation area, but let me ask you this. Did you ever try moose?
Did I try what?
Moose? Moose, you know, the thing with Rocky and Bullwinkle, the thing with the giant horns. You ever eat any moose?
No, but I've seen plenty of them.
Well, that's
in Montana.
That's good. So what should the state's policy briefly be on illegals? Just kick them out.
Follow the law.
Kick them out if they
follow
find
the
them.
Law, Kim.
All right. Thanks for the call, Ralph. Have a good day. All right, folks. I've eaten plenty of moose. Plenty of moose. I've eaten plenty of elk. Moose is pretty tasty. I give you that. All right. So Robert's saying $800,000 per year range. So we're fighting desperately to get money for squad cars, to get money to keep good officers. Las Cruces uses DASO to train its officers. When they get trained and they're tired of not making enough money, they rotate, right? So here's the thing. I mean, there's a lot of, it's like what we were talking about yesterday, this kind of self-righteous leftism that doesn't really seem to have any connection with reality. And are we going to give up hundreds of millions of billions of dollars in this state so we can be a sanctuary city? I mean, here's another question that's more profound, I think. Leftism, as you see from Ted Koppel, presents itself as true across the board in all instances. Is it in fact true that the only right thing to do here is to just leave these people alone? Is that the only genuinely wise or smart or legal thing to do, as the left suggests? A second directive by county manager's office issued in 2014 ended a Doña Ana County detention center policy of carrying out immigration or ICE holds on which people jailed at the detention center would be held at the request of federal immigration officers as they were in the country illegally. Now, how do you think about people that are picked up that are here breaking the law, and the one agency says, we're not going to do the work of this other agency, even though, realistically speaking, all of these people are down in Doña Ana Correctional anyway. Now, Doña Ana faced a lawsuit in 2013 for detaining without justification two women who faced misdemeanors. Overall, 70,000 immigrants were living illegally in New Mexico in 2012, a decline of 20,000 from 2009. And here they're calling it 3.4% of the total residents of the state. So downtown Julia Brown says, obviously, if they have a warrant or a court order, we'll honor that. But just to call up and say, will you hold somebody for us? I don't think so. That's not appropriate. All right. So there isn't a formal estimate for how many immigrants living illegally in the U.S. are in Doña Ana County. However, if the same statewide percentage is applied to Doña Ana County's population of about 214,000, that would mean 7,300 people were living in the county without documentation. So, all right. So anyway, would you be willing to, in the one of the poorest areas in the United States, to give up federal funding? Think about it. Are you willing to give up federal funding from a group of people who very well may be already taking funds from the state that properly belong to legal residents? Just a question. 728 Kelly O'Connell AM, Las Cruces, 1450-523-1450. We'll be right back.
1-800-951-0995. Today's song. Of course, we're taking good care of you, doing the first quote one out of all of it. It's two of a kind, working on a full house. With the first verse of the song. So this should be pretty easy. 1-800-951-0995. Here's your lyric. You gotta tell me how. And she's my lady love. Hey, I'm a wild heart man. And how does the lyric roll from there? 5-800-951-0995. Call number 9.
All right, so if you're listening yesterday, there was I think it was a text from Frankie, who no longer calls in. He doesn't really have the heart to call in anymore. He doesn't really have the energy. He lays at home. He's got his, I don't want to give away all his secrets, but from what I understand, his whiskey is now in a baby bottle, and he lays in bed and watches MSNBC and takes a few tugs on the bottle every few minutes. But anyway, so to Frankie, heaven on earth is socialism. And so he's encouraged me repeatedly to look up Sweden. And I've looked it up, and there's a kind of an interesting article out there. Now, he claimed it was the happiest city in the world. I did some research on that and found it was number 9. So it's not the happiest city in the world, but here's a more trenchant issue here is that Sweden is not socialist. As a matter of fact, in some ways, America is more socialist. Socialism, let's be totally honest here, is when the government owns the creation and delivery. They call it the means of production, which is kind of a mark, you know, from Karl Marx's mouth. But it's really the creation and delivery of property, of goods, of services. Scandinavia in general doesn't do that. But anyway, here's an interesting article, August 2015, Kelly MacDonald. I would highly encourage you to go look it up, federalist.com. Scandinavia isn't a socialist paradise. She goes through this and says, basically, and there's a couple of takeaways from this. Number one is that, see, I want to sum this up here without getting too deep into it. As a matter of fact, let me just play a clip for you. This is a very short clip from a guy, Johan Norberg.
I live in one of the best countries on the planet, Sweden. We tax and we spend and we have a huge government. And we're one of the world's richest countries. You should be more like us. Dead wrong. Sweden got rich first with free trade and an open economy before we had the big government. In 1950, Sweden was already one of the world's richest countries. And back then, taxes were lower in Sweden than in the United States. Only then did we start expanding the government dramatically. And you know what happened then? We started losing. From having been the fourth richest country in the world in 1970, 25 years later, we were only the 14th richest. And no new jobs had been created in the private sector. It all ended in a terrible crisis. Since then, Sweden has become successful again, but only after a new reform period, with more deregulation and free trade than in other countries, with lower taxes, school vouchers, and partial privatization of the pension system. Sure, Sweden is great. I love it here. But be careful so that you imitate the stuff that brought us wealth, and not the stuff that almost brought us ruin.
So what happened is Sweden was really falling apart from this tax and spend liberalism. And so reformers came in starting in, I think, 2010 and started bringing in important reforms into the country. But to go from the number four economy in the world, a small country like that, to fall down pretty far. And so that's the answer, Frankie, to be quite honest, it's not a socialist paradise. Now, looking for some facts out of this article here. Scandinavian countries aren't socialist. One of the reasons it is incorrect to refer to countries like Sweden as socialist is that these countries were once far more progressive than they are now. The Economist says Sweden was once tax and spend economy, which author Astrid Lindgren of Pippi Longstocking fame was required to pay more than 100% of her income in taxes. This heavily progressive tax rate stunted economic growth, and Sweden fell from fourth wealthiest to the 14th wealthiest in just 23 years. The government realized the trouble and instituted several capitalist reforms to resuscitate the economy. And according to The Economist, following the success of Sweden's relatively right-leaning moderate party, quote, Swedish GDP is growing strongly and unemployment is falling. The budget is heading into a surplus next year. So anyway, you cannot have at the same time both socialism and a success or a successful economy. Those two things don't work together. And why is it that leftists think that the world needs to be based on what they think is fair as opposed to reality? That's a scary thought. So looking for any other facts in here. That's a basic picture. I don't want to get too far into this. I do want to get into, though, the rape crisis that has come as a result of their crazy immigration policies, which were not reformed by the right-leaning government. Sweden is now the rape capital of the world. Therefore, how could it be the happiest country, Frankie? Shame on you. Gatestone Institute.
Hi, I'm Ingrid Carlqvist for the Gatestone Institute. Once upon a time, there was a safe welfare state called Sweden. This beautiful part of Sweden that we call Skåne is where my forefathers lived as long back as I have been able to research, the beginning of the 18th century. Now, Sweden has turned into Absurdistan, a country that has one of the highest number of reported rapes in the world. Hundreds of so-called exclusion areas, more than 55 no-go zones where police and ambulance get and Sharia law is becoming more important than Swedish law. Once upon a time, people rarely locked their doors in this area. Now, this country is a night watchman state. Each man is on his own. Last year, 163,000 asylum seekers came to Sweden, and even though we have since then introduced border controls, the prognosis is that somewhere between 70,000 and 140,000 will come this year to a country with a total population of 9.5 million. In November last year, I interviewed salesmen from several security companies. They all said that there is a really high demand for alarm systems right now. One of them said, "It is largely due to the turbulence we are seeing around the country. People have lost confidence in the state. The police will not come anymore." One of the things that Swedes are most scared of is rape. Even though it's forbidden to keep statistics on the rapist's ethnic background or religion, we know who is behind the near 100% increase of rapes in Sweden. Almost every day we can read in the so-called alternative media about rapes against Swedish women and girls committed by asylum seekers or other migrants from the third world. Up until a few decades ago, no one had heard about gang rape. Now it happens every week. This has, of course, been going on for many years, but the Swedes have been so brainwashed by the government and the mainstream media that no one has protested about the rape on Sweden. But that has all changed. These days, no one can escape the horrible realities. Just a couple of miles from here is a little village that used to have 900 inhabitants. But last year, the authorities placed 400 asylum seekers in that little village. That means that almost half of the total population is now people from Somalia, Eritrea, Afghanistan, and Syria. It's really turned the whole village upside down around there. At first, they were happy to welcome people to their part of the world. They arranged lunches and Christmas celebrations and donated clothing to the migrants. Now, many of the locals are afraid and confused. With tears in their eyes, they tell me how their friendly village has been totally transformed by these young, aggressive male asylum seekers. The asylum seekers scream at the locals, call the women whores, they steal from the shops, and don't seem at all grateful or happy to be here. Many wonder what these asylum seekers expected when they arrived in Sweden. Daily Svenska Dagbladet interviewed Salar from Iraq, who complained, "We can't sit here and wait for the decision on residence permit indefinitely. We sit at the asylum house all day long and do nothing. Our children have nothing to do. There is no playground here. And the food that is served here is strange. It doesn't at all look like the food we are used to." Salar is not alone. Actually, more people are going back to Iraq now than coming here. This year, 1,240.
All right, so you get the message there. Paradise, Frankie, why don't you move over there? Take a break and got some local weather for you. 523-1450. On AM Las Cruces at 7:43 on the 28th day of March. And I've got a little bit more, not on Sweden, but we'll come back and talk a little bit more about leftism.
When you can't find the light that guides you through a cloudy day, when the stars ain't shining bright, you feel like you've lost your way.
Okay, so there is an interesting documentary. I'm just going to play a little bit of it regarding, you know, bearing in mind the amount of time that we have. But you remember when in 2015, the girl at Yale University, I think she's an African-American girl, screamed at the professor who was a proctor. He's basically, an overseer. He's a kind of a warder, you know, a person who hangs around the living areas and helps kids. And she screamed at him that he had not created a safe space. And what started that was a debate over what costume should be allowed for Halloween. And Yale was actually directing people to be what kind of costumes they could have. Now, let me just tell you a little bit about Yale. Harvard was the first university, considered by some people the greatest university in the world. Harvard was the first university in America, and then it was founded as a minister's college. As Harvard became more liberal, and it's the inevitable nature of universities to become more liberal because they bring in the latest teachings and thinkings and stuff, which invariably go against conservative ideas. And Yale was then started because Harvard had become too liberal. I mean, this is an ancient problem. Here's a little bit from this clip, though. What has Yale become from the We the Internet documentary?
Welcome to Yale. This place, one of the most prestigious universities in the world, birthed what's probably the most famous clip of the campus free speech controversies.
You did not sleep at night!
We're out!
You're disgusting!
Early last week, a student confronted a head of one of Yale's undergraduate residents.
This insufferable brat.
You can't wear the Halloween costume you want.
How much speech is too much?
I had a suspicion that the public backlash missed what that outburst really meant. That the fixation on free speech ignored a deeper, darker scandal afflicting Yale. So I went there, and I found my scandal. What do you really know about the place that produces the people that run our country? Halloween 2015. An administrative committee sends out an email urging students not to wear appropriative Halloween costumes and outlining some extremely broad rules. Yale lecturer Erica Christakis pushed.
Now, what they meant was, for example, you don't dress up as a Native American because you don't have a right to wear a headdress or, you know, you see the point.
She's back. She worries about creeping censorship and notes that the ability to tolerate is a central feature of a free and open society. Her email prompts a disproportionate response.
So important to give students of color a chance to heal from all the pain that we've been experiencing this week.
People were so caught up in their own political roles that they were unable to realize, wait, maybe she has a point, that we don't have to rely on higher authorities to tell us how we should be dressing.
An open letter signed by more than 700 students and faculty condemns Erica's email as racist. Curiously, the letter was written by an undergrad who that very Halloween violated the committee's rules with his Aladdin costume. Activists flocked to the courtyard of Silliman, the residential community where Erica's family lives, to chalk taunting messages. Nicholas, her husband, comes out to meet them. Word gets around, and he's surrounded.
So who gets to decide what's offensive? Who gets to decide, guys? What if everybody says, I am hurt? Does that mean everyone else has to stop speaking?
Nicholas is the head of Silliman and a superstar professor at Yale, a best-selling author, Time 100 nominee, and a regular on the TED Talk circuit.
I had met Nicholas because he was a big recruit. He has a whole half a floor downstairs. And Nicholas is a great scientist who's probably saving thousands of lives in the developing world.
To whom should we give these interventions so that if they adopt the intervention, the whole village will adopt the intervention?
All right. So anyway, this guy who's a great professor and is a humanitarian, he's working on saving people in the third world, gets attacked by these people. Now, when you see pictures of Yale, at least in this video, it looks like the United Nations. It's just a completely diverse, totally diversified, black and Indian and Asian and everything. And so they've totally diversified the student body, but that's not really a problem. The problem is the ideas that they've taught these people is you cannot be offended because you have a right not to be offended. Now, here's a little bit on the history of Harvard College. I couldn't find a history of Yale online in YouTube, but I found one of Harvard, and I thought, well, it'd just, be a similar thing. Harvard created from the legacy of John Harvard, who sent his books and money to establish a university, really a college in the New World, so that when the ministers who were then alive lay in the dust of the grave, there would be a new generation of ministers to feed the flock, to raise up a new Christian generation. Which, if you can believe, that was what Harvard was started to be.
Hi, I'm Dr. Kenan Curitan, and we're on a search for lost episodes from American history. And here we are outside of Harvard University, and some might know that Harvard was America's first college. However, did you know that the college was named for the Reverend John Harvard, or that it was founded to train ministers?
The primary purpose of this place was to train ministers of the gospel to preach the scriptures. Since that time, things have changed dramatically.
The school was founded in 1636, barely 7 years after the Puritans first began to settle here in Massachusetts. The Reverend John Harvard was a young minister who died of tuberculosis soon after he arrived from England. To honor his memory, the General Court of Massachusetts named the school after the Reverend Harvard. His generous donation helped construct some of the buildings for the new school. The library was founded in 1638 with his donated books, and is now the oldest library in all of America.
The first 300 years of Harvard's existence, maybe a little bit less than 300 years, practically every president of Harvard was a pious, convinced believer in Jesus Christ. Many of Harvard's presidents were ministers as well. Until the 1960s, Harvard required that all their students attend the chapel every day.
What about the original purpose for education at Harvard? Well, according to the words behind me, etched in stone, here on campus, it was to be a seminary for the training of ministers. Written in Old English, you find these words. After God had carried us safe to New England, and we had built our houses, provided necessaries for our livelihood, reared convenient places for God's worship, and settled the civil government, one of the next things we longed for and looked after was to advance learning and perpetuate it to posterity, dreading to leave an illiterate ministry to the churches when our present minister shall lie in the dust. We can also learn a lot about Harvard by looking at some of its earliest rules, such as the laws and statutes for students of Harvard College. That begins by stating, let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life. The students were expected to spend personal time in the scriptures at least twice a day, memorize the scriptures, and be able to recite these on command if called upon by their teachers. They were also to know Latin, the language of most theological writings of the time, and they were also expected to know Hebrew and Greek in order to be able to translate the scriptures from their original languages. Now imagine, if these rules were reinstituted at Harvard today, there would almost assuredly be a riot on that campus right there.
In the beginning, the founders of this university, Harvard University, and other universities, valued biblical truth as the kind of bedrock upon which ideas were going to be built. It was the kind of foundation upon which philosophies were developed and structures were grown.
It's interesting, if you go back to the Puritan Revolution, which occurs in England in the around 1650, what you have is the Bible in the vernacular. The fight in England was over a church that was to be either the central church in the culture, the Anglican church, the state church, or if they would be allowed by law to have other churches. Now, you have the Congregationalists, who were in the first wave. Congregationalists brought their theory of church government, which was translated. It was brought over to the United States and became the foundation for democracy over here, believe it or not. We didn't get our theory of democracy from ancient Greece or Rome. So, incredible intellectual explosion that happens around the time of the Puritan Revolution, because you brought in the Bible in the vernacular, the Bible in the English language, the famous King James Bible, which creates a massive explosion for learning, and they're applying it in every place possible. And it's really something to see the result of that. And we were transplanted here during that very time, right before the Puritan Revolution in England. And so we carry on the same spirit. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 759. Great hanging out with you, and we'll meet you back in 22 hours. Ciao.
The candle let him home, run so very far away. Now you gotta let your soul shine, just like my daddy used to say. Better than sunshine.